During Al-Qaeda's heyday in the mid-2000s, jihadists filmed much of their activity, from training and wheelbarrow races to suicide manifestos and the terrorist attacks themselves. For the first time, that footage has been compiled and released. Director Jonathan Hacker's harrowing documentary, The Path of Blood, made by Paladin, gives us a close-up and uneditorialized view of jihadism. Hacker is here in the studio with us today, joined by former Al-Qaeda recruiter and current counterterrorism consultant, Jesse Morton. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, Jonathan, I have to ask, how did you even end up with these tapes?
Oh, I wish I could take credit for it. It was actually one of the executive producers whose name was Abdulrahman Al-Rashed. He used to be an editor at Ashraq Al-Awsat, which is the largest Arab world newspaper, and then he was general manager of Al-Arabiya. And he'd heard about the footage and managed to persuade the Ministry of Interior in Saudi Arabia to release it for us to make a film. And in so doing, he also managed to persuade them to let us have police CSI footage, you know, when the police film the aftermath of, turn up at the aftermath of explosions or shootouts, they film it. And of course, it wasn't just the aftermath of shootouts that they, it was also shootouts themselves, the raids and so on. So we had this two sets of footage, the Al-Qaeda footage that had been captured by the security forces and the security force footage. And that enabled us to cut a thriller together in a way, cat and mouse story of the Al-Qaeda footage on the one hand and the security services on the other, and tell the story of a whole Al-Qaeda campaign from its birth through to its defeat in 2006, 2009, that roughly that period.
And of course, for English-speaking audiences, much of what's in the documentary had to be translated. And I'm wondering if there was any difficulty in that, because it seems like there's so much casual conversation going on and things can get lost in translation.
Well, it was a huge job. We had like 500 hours of footage here. So it was a huge job going through it. And a lot of it was Bedouin dialects, slang. So it was a tough job, but we had a good team and we spent a lot of time doing it, because we knew that the gems that were made its way into the film are hidden in amongst a lot of dross. You know, when you're going through 500 hours, there's a lot of stuff in there that's very boring. But you find these little moments that were actually incredible, moments of bizarre humor, great visual images that people didn't even know they were filming an image. But, you know, as a filmmaker, you suddenly see it and think, wow, that's fantastic. Little moments of stillness, little moments that there's one moment in the film where Al-Qaeda film themselves praying, and as they bow down to face Mecca, you see that in front of them a row of guns and Kalashnikovs and rocket launchers, and you realize there's a metaphor there. They're praying towards the guns, you know. And I think it's little moments like that that came out of the footage through all of the hard work that we did sifting it.
All right, and just one more question, Jonathan, before I move on to Jesse. You mentioned bizarre humor, and I think that's one of the things that sort of struck me watching the film. What were your first impressions when you saw this raw footage of what you were looking at?
Well, there were obviously a lot of distressing moments. You've got, you know, some very violent action being shown. But then there were these strange moments that were incredibly revealing. I think one of the things that we really wanted to get across with the film is to humanize Al-Qaeda. And when you see that they are just, you know, naive kids in some cases, not all of them, but in some cases naive and often stupid, it's suddenly you realize they are human beings, you know. And there's the in this group, there's the class clown over there, there's the idiot over there, there's the sort of the leader person over there, you know. And you start to suddenly realize that there are these tropes, these kind of characters that you can relate to. And it's one of the, I think, strangely disorientating things about the film, is you suddenly realize, wow, I can relate to these kids. They're laughing around, playing, you know, doing wheelbarrow races in the desert on their training exercises. And you suddenly realize they are human beings. They're not the two-dimensional kind of villains that we have in our imagination. And I think it's important to see them in that wider...
Well, that is, I mean, there's, I think most Americans, when they think of Al-Qaeda, there's that looped film that we've seen over and over again of them sort of like training or working out on like a jungle gym or something. But to see them, you know, doing wheelbarrow races was jarring, I have to say, as a viewer. So, Jesse, I wanted to get your take, because the film opens with this segment of a young jihadist named Ali, and he's sort of filming his manifesto, getting ready to talk about, I guess, a suicide bombing. But he's completely goofing off in the entire, and it's humanizing, and yet it's still incredibly disturbing when you realize what this person's about to go do. I just want you to give us an idea of what's the frame of mind.
Well, I think that what you have is the example of someone who has been intoxicated by an ideology, but at the same time, I think the power of the film in general, and particularly in that clip as an introductory section, is that it shows this cognitive dissonance between what you see in the final cut of jihadist propaganda versus what you see behind the scenes. So, for example, when we found and discovered tapes and material in the Abbottabad raids, we saw Osama bin Laden dressing himself up, dyeing his beard, and rehearsing his skits. But the final product looks exemplary. For this individual, you could very much tell that he was lost and confused. At the same time, he was motivated by the group that he belonged to. And it's really essentially the social psychological process that works. You embed yourself in a movement and you can be driven due to the zeal inside of that movement to commit acts that to the general human being just go against the intrinsic part of humanity. This person's willing to sacrifice, and then in the rehearsal makes it apparent that he doesn't even know why or how he's gotten into the position that he's in. He's totally intoxicated.
You see him sort of pause several times when he's asked about what is it that you're going to be doing or why. Do you feel as though with that intoxication then that there's an understanding of what it is that they're doing, a full understanding?
I don't think there's a full understanding. I think that what happens with regard to extremist narratives is that they create this Manichaean worldview of the us versus them that can be incredibly intoxicating to the point where a person is willing to blow themselves up on behalf of a movement. And what's apparent to me is that even the ideological justification that Al-Qaeda gives with regard to framing the religion in a way that would justify such an atrocity, he doesn't even understand it nor grasp it. And that creation of that cognitive dissonance is very important. It's very powerful.
He says, when the question is asking him, a relatively straightforward question, he says, don't use such long words. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the class fool.
Mm-hmm. And it's apparent that he has been indoctrinated and trained and is supposed to know the evidences as explained by Al-Qaeda in order to justify the attack, and he can't even recite them. So he's essentially embedded himself in a movement where he becomes, for lack of a better term, a useful idiot. The ignoramuses are the ones that get put on the front lines to blow themselves up. The leadership, who is supposed to be the ones that are most passionate about believing in the ideology, never go into the front lines, or particularly when regard to the suicide bombings that they justify. We don't see the leadership ever engage in them.
But in the film, you hear the questioning behind, you know, you hear the guy behind the camera asking
attempting
the
questions. To be serious.
Yeah. You're prompting him, and you hear the control going on. You hear the manipulation going on from the cameraman talking behind the camera. And in other scenes, likewise, you've got, there's a very upsetting scene where you see them interrogating Paul Marshall Johnson later on in the film, who is a poor individual that they'd captured and later executed, and you hear the line of interrogation, and there you see that they're not all naive idiots. Some of them are get a kick off the power that they have, the hatred that they have. They're intoxicated in that situation, and you can see the darker side of the human soul coming out there. I think one of the things about the film is obviously very specifically about the jihadist phenomena, what's going on with these kids with this phenomenon, of our age, really. But it's, I think, when you watch it, because of the way we've put it together, there are wider psychological things that you start to realize apply to a lot of political movements throughout history. You know, that we are, that human beings like to have simple political philosophies. They like to feel that they have destiny on their side. They like to feel part of a group united in brotherly love, in hatred against somebody else. And that this is something that we see here in Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but is also existing throughout history.
And I was going to say that sense of belonging that I think I've seen in other pieces that are sort of dealing with extremist groups, that's what that gives a lot of these, I guess, for lack of a better description, lost individuals, mm-hmm. is a place and a sense to belong to. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about, because you mentioned the gentleman who was shown in the video, the American contractor, I believe, who was unfortunately executed. But you see his face in the documentary, where there's some other people where their faces are blurred out and you can't see who they are. And I'm wondering why there was a distinction between the two.
Basically, when we were trying to work out how to handle how explicit to make certain sections of the film. There's a lot of scenes that are quite violent or distressing. We felt that it was important not to make that terrorism, we should be uncompromising in how we look at terrorism. You know, it is a dreadful, evil phenomena. And So when we showed the victims of terrorism, we were careful to frame out their faces wherever we could. The Paul Marshall Johnson scene, we couldn't really frame it out because that was all that there was in the shot. But you hear the line of questioning from the interrogators, which I think was very revealing onto their mindset, you know, that they're interested in how much money he's earning, which has got absolutely no relation to anything, you know, of what it is. No, there's no political relationship to it. And they clearly are looking, their line of questioning, they're trying to force him to say certain things. And what is particularly chilling about that scene is the ending of it, where you suddenly realize that there are children in the room afterwards. And again, I think that's very real. It brings home to you how normalized the violence of what it is, of what they're doing, how normalized. They don't see anything wrong in it. There's no sense, and even like they could have a child in the room.
Well, that's actually another scene in the film where we see a jihadist who's actually teaching his two very young sons how to do like these barrel rolls and then execute somebody with a gun. I guess, were there a lot of children around?
I mean, it's part of the power of a propaganda that is basically conveying the fact that we are acting now and we realize that we are small scale, but we are training a generation to come forward. And this is what we see with what the ISIS calls the cubs of the caliphate, this promotion that, yes, you may take us out of territorial control today and power today, but increasingly since the 9/11 and up until now, we are not just waging a war that is going to be immediate. We're waging a war of attrition, and it's going to require the generation that follows us to wage that as well. And you can see that this has history and precedent going all the way back to this very early period of 2003 to 2006 that this powerful film addresses.
I think it's they're proud of what they're doing, you know. For these people, the executions, the acts of violence are normalized. In fact, they are acts of what they consider to be noble acts. And so we look at it with horror, but they don't look at it with horror. They look at it with pride, what they're doing. And I think that's what comes across in the film.
And even deeper than that, the way that it's framed by jihadists is that these acts of violence are actually worship to the Creator. They actually consider this an act of worship, jihad, even though terrorism is not jihad. In true Islam, they have framed jihad as terrorism and terrorism as jihad. And so it's an act of worship in the room.
They're doing God's will. Their destiny is on their side.
Interesting. Is that why they were videotaping everything?
Well, I mean, the videotaping is to promote the justification. So you can see them force the contractor to say, I mean, he has no clue what would be the justification for his killing. And the only thing that they can arrive at is the fact that he teaches Saudis how to repair helicopters. And so they're force feeding this to try to come up with a justification to kill him. And I think that that's essentially filming that. The idea is to promote this widespread practice, and you can see that it was imitated in Iraq by Zarqawi, who was leading al-Qaeda in Iraq when he started the decapitation of Nicholas Berg, and now we see the decapitation has become a sort of cult phenomenon inside the jihadist movement, so it certainly set a precedent.
Okay. So if that's what they're, the place that they're coming at this from, was there any concern about showing them as human or too human?
Well, I think the way we tried to edit it was that you very much saw the consequences of their actions, so that we have these scenes where you see them plotting and carrying out acts of violence, and then you see the consequences of their actions, the victims, that they're killing ordinary Muslims in many situations, although they think that they're targeting unbelievers, they're actually killing other Muslims. And what we're trying to do when we cut it together was let them be damned by their own words, let them be damned by their own actions. The commentary doesn't pass comment at all. We're totally dispassionate in the way in which we cut the film, but the actions and the choices we've made allow them to damn themselves.
All right, well listen, thank you for joining me today. I've been speaking with filmmaker Jonathan Hacker about his documentary Path of Blood, along with Jesse Morton, who's featured in the film.